It's time for Money for Lunch, where we feed your brain and your business with supersized portions of business and financial news. Now your host, Bert Martinez.
Hoo-ah! Hey, welcome. Welcome, welcome to Money for Lunch. Money for Lunch Nation, out there making things happen. Got a great email yesterday from Susan. I'll just go with that. I don't know if she wants me to disclose her last name. Anyway, Susan via Twitter, thank you so much. Awesome email, says she has been listening to the show for over a year, loves it. Thank you so much. We appreciate that kind of feedback so very, very much. Our listeners are a big part of the show. You guys make things happen for us in a lot of big ways. Not only do you give us support, but you also give us great show topics, guest suggestion, all that stuff really makes a difference. Let's make Money for Lunch the best show out there. And so if you have an idea, a suggestion, hit me up, Facebook or Twitter or even Instagram, Bert Martinez. All right, let's get this party started. My first guest is Pamela Lenihan. Pamela Lenihan was one of the first female partners on Wall Street, a former C-suite executive on the New York Stock Exchange of a New York Stock Exchange company, and a high-tech startup. She combined a climb to the vanguard of business leadership with passionate dedication to raising her children. An avid believer in the power of women to lead as well as parent, she serves on the boards of three publicly traded firms and is also the author of What Do You Know and Your Boss Won't Tell You. Advice from senior female executives on what you need to succeed. Today we're going to be talking about motherhood and working do mix. Pamela Lenihan, welcome to Money for Lunch.
Thank you for having me, Bert.
You bet, you bet. All right, so let's talk about this. Your book, My Mother, My Mentor, What Grown Children of Working Mothers Want You to Know. So tell us a little bit about what was the inspiration to write the book?
Well, I raised my children a generation ago. My daughter and son are in the workplace and have families of their own, and yet every place I go, working mothers today are still asking the same questions. How did you do it? And they're still feeling guilty. And that's really, they shouldn't be feeling guilty. Today, 70% of women with children under the age of 18 are in the workforce. So we need to get over this guilt. It's just a fact of life.
Where did this guilt come from? How did this thing even occur?
Well, you know, it's very confusing because 60% of Americans think that children would be better off if one parent stayed at home. And yet I knew that my kids turned out well, and I wanted to do some research to see how other kids did. And it turns out that the children think working is normal. That's just what their mother does. So I don't know why mothers continue to feel guilty. I think it could be that just society expects one parent to stay at home, but that's not realistic in today's economic environment. So I think we as a society have to help mothers feel less guilty.
Well, and I think that, you know, for the working moms out there, look, you need to make a decision. Part of it is either you're going to work and, you know, figure out how to raise your parents while you work, or raise your children while you work, or you're not going to work. This thought of, you know, I'm at work, I should be at home, and I'm at home, I should be at work, this back and forth doesn't do anybody any good. Maybe you need to start a part-time job, part-time business, or, you know, as Pamela, as you did, you know, you go in there, you know, full force. I tell you what, my mom was a working mom, and just like you were saying, I just thought it was normal. In fact, growing up, there was very few moms that were stay-home moms, and most of the stay-home moms had small children. As soon as those children got to a certain age, I remember all of them going back to the workplace. You know, sometimes it's for the money and sometimes it's just for fulfillment. I mean, look, staying at home, especially if your kids are going to be in school for most of the day, other than cleaning a house or doing some domestic work, you know, and again, unless you're an entrepreneur working from home, you know, might as well go out there and you know, and I don't know, do something for yourself. And that is sometimes getting a job that you like. That's a great way of having some fulfillment and keeping yourself sharp, right?
Well, first of all, I think we all acknowledge that all women, all mothers work, whether they get paid for working outside the home or not.
Yes,
so I don't want to say
that
women who've chosen to stay at home don't work. They work hard, and a lot of them are out working in their communities. But the fact is that a lot of parents have to have two salaries coming in to live in the school districts they want or to buy the house they want or just to get things for their kids, and that's just a fact. And there are a lot of positives for children, actually, when the mothers work, that these children report they're more independent than the children whose mothers stay at home. They report that they're proud of their working mothers. And they also have the working mothers use after-school activities and sports to keep these kids occupied, knowing that there's that time between when school gets out and parents get home from work that you've got to do something with the kids. And so they enroll them in all these activities. And because of that, the children of working parents report having more good friends at all levels of elementary, middle, and high school than the children whose mothers stay at home. So it's not that these children are not doing well. In fact, they're doing very well. And I think that's sometimes something we forget.
Absolutely. I remember, you know, years ago there was a whole thing about latchkey kids. You know, yeah, sometimes your kids are by themselves and they, you know, they have to lock themselves in. But I like this whole idea of being more independent. You know, it's interestingly enough, the kids that I grew up with who both parents worked are more independent, have a much better social skills. You know, they learned how to cook. You know, they learned how to iron their own clothes because they had to sometimes. You know, they had to get ready for maybe an after-school deal, and they had to prepare their uniform for that. And so there's absolutely nothing wrong with it. I think that the thing that is a challenge is when you maybe never stop, right? I mean, if you bring your work home and you're constantly working and you're not making time for your kids, that is probably when you need to reevaluate your situation and dial it back a little bit, because you have to make time for the kids.
Right, but I think what we really need to realize is that it's how you spend the hours you have with your children. And so
yes.
When I interviewed the children, the times that they really like were very simple things. So when I asked children, grown children, what some of their favorite memories were, one that came up a lot was grocery shopping. And so I remember I used to go home and pick up my daughter and drive back to the grocery store and put her in the cart and walk up and down the aisles and talk about things that were on the shelves. And she swears that she learned how to read in the grocery store. And other children talked about loving to you know, go to other places with their parents or to clean house with their parents. The most favorite activity of all the children, 2-to-1, was family dinner. So it's not that you need to do these things all the time with your children, but
right. All
of those things that we view as tasks, they view as really fun activities. And so use those chores that you have to take your children along and have great conversations.
Absolutely. I like the whole idea of doing the grocery shopping together or some of these other activities that might be mundane, but it is a time for you to connect. It is a time
for you.
They
really are. You know, you throw your child in the back of a car and think of how these great conversations you have. Turn off the radio and,
yes.
You know, if they're older, ask them to put away their phones or take out the earbuds and have a conversation. And you really have some great, you know, trips when you to start discussing things with your kids.
All right, let me ask you this. When it comes to when you were doing your research, was there anything that the grown children that might have said something that surprised you?
Well, one thing I think that did surprise me is that they reported having more good friends at all levels of school. And so I never really had thought about that I think that working parents are very deliberate at finding other activities for their kids so that the children of working parents participated in sports more often, especially the girls, than the children whose mothers stayed at home, and they also participated in other activities. So I thought that was very interesting. And it's really this whole idea of there's a village that surrounds our children. It's the teachers, the coaches, the grandparents. It's not just the parents who are raising these children. We really do have this notion that we're doing it alone. But when you step back and think about it, you really have a lot of other adults who have a positive influence on your children.
Yeah, you know what, and I want to back up a little bit and bring this, I guess, back around. You know, let's see, I'm 50-something years old, and I think that I say this because, you know, my mom worked, my dad worked. I mean, working moms have been around forever. So why do you think that this is still this deal? I mean, why are we still talking about it? In the beginning of the segment, we're talking about there's a lot of guilt associated with this. Why do you think that is?
I am not sure why there's so much guilt. I was speaking somewhere, and a woman came up to me afterwards who turned out to be a pastor of a church. And she said that she had always been a working mother, but her mother had not worked. And she said it's interesting because she saw research that showed that it's really only most women in this world have worked. And it's only in the United States that it is our mother's generation who did not work, and therefore we're feeling guilty. But our grandmothers probably did work. So it's only when we made this transition sort of from the farm to the city that women had this life of leisure because they weren't needed as much. So I don't know if that is actually true, and I don't know if that's the source of our guilt. But I know that, for example, my daughter is now a working mother herself, and she does not feel guilty because she saw me being a working mother, and she knows that she and her brother turned out well. So I think that the more examples we have of working mothers and happy children, the less guilt that these working mothers are going to feel.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I love this. The book, again, is My Mother, My Mentor, What Grown Children of Working Mothers Want You to Know. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and then we'll be back right after this with Pamela Lenihan to talk more about working mothers.
Well, I'm not sure what it is. I guess I'll be okay.
I'm calling the studio, Matthew.
You're not shooting today.
Just get some rest.
He bought it.
Hi, can I get my CRV brought up, please?
Roderick. Roderick.
Life is packed with things you have to do.
But sometimes you gotta live a little.
Matthew, you poor thing. You sound awful.
I resist.
Look, I don't know what to tell you. He's sick. Actors get sick sometimes.
Thanks.
Have a good night.
Life moves pretty fast. If you don't stop and look around once in a while, you could miss it.
Get going in the all-new CR-V from Honda.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.
All right, we are back. We are chatting with Pamela Lenihan, best-selling author of the book, My Mother, My Mentor, What Grown Children of Working Mothers Want You to Know. And this is, to me, what a great book. It's probably about time that we have a book that talks about working moms because, as I said earlier, you know, this has been going on forever, and it's still like a thing. It's still something that we talk about so much as though it's a new thing, and, you know, and it really isn't. Let me ask you this, Pamela. What is the one piece of advice that you would give the grown children of – that you would want the grown children of working mothers to know?
Well, what the mothers – the grown children and the working mothers want – mothers of today to know is that you should just relax and enjoy the time you have with your children because they grow up so quickly. And so just take those times we talked about, whether it's the grocery shopping or the errands or just being around the house, and enjoy each other's company.
Yes. You know, what a very simple yet sometimes something that we don't do. We certainly take it for granted. We don't treasure those moments, because in those moments are really where some of our best memories come from. As you said, you know, it's the grocery shopping together or running around doing stuff together, you know, having dinner together. I think that, you know, it's interesting. Excuse me. My wife works, and when she works late, sometimes I will have dinner we have a couple kids left at home, and we'll sit around the TV. And it dawned on me after doing this a couple times that this is an incorrect way to spend that time together. I certainly wouldn't do it with my wife home. Sorry about that. I had to hit the cough button there. But you don't have to do anything extravagant, but having your meals together, sharing some time together, this is, you know, even doing a few errands together, this is a great time for you to communicate on different topics of importance to your kids. And sometimes in these casual settings is where you have the best conversations.
I think it really is, and it's just sitting there listening to the children. I know that there was
one
family I spoke to where the parents had been divorced, and there was a second marriage, and so they arranged through their spouses to be sure that all of the children were together one night a week. And the daughter was telling me the story many years later. She was a grown-up now, and she said that we had to tell people what was the best part of our week and the worst part of the week. And at the time, they thought it was all very corny, but she said now she and her siblings thought about this and thought it was really just a wonderful way to spend their evening. So I think that we as parents just kind of rush through the day and we think about things as chores we have to check off. But these are just great times to communicate with your kids.
It is. And definitely cheaper than buying them electronics or gadgets or clothing or whatever to try to sometimes, offset, as you and I were talking about earlier, offset the guilt that some mothers feel. Pamela, we're out of time, but I want to, again, plug the book one more time. It's called My Mother, My Mentor, What Grown Children of Working Mothers Want You to Know. Pamela Lenihan, thank you so much for stopping by and sharing.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
You bet. Good stuff there. I am proud of my mom who worked, and I'm sure that you guys have the same experience. This might be a great book for you guys to look at, and maybe even buy the book for some of your grown kids as they're experiencing their own, motherhood, if you will. All right, quick commercial break. We'll be back right after this.
Welcome back to Geico Radio. It's savings on the radio.
Cooler Steve. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I just got a free rate quote on geico.com. Saved a ton, and it only took me 5 minutes and 12 seconds. I was wondering, is that some sort of record?
That's a good question. Let's have a look.
Not quite. Someone's got you beat by 8 seconds.
Still, I mean, that's quite fast.
Well, what if I told you I only use one hand?
Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.
All right, we are back. My next guest, Rick Roberts. Rick Roberts is a comedian and keynote speaker. He splits his time between performing and speaking at corporate events and fundraiser. He is the host of the School of Laughs podcast, available on Stitcher, iTunes, and also at schooloflaughs.com, schooloflaughs.com. And I'm excited to have him on the show to talk about what he does. Rick Roberts, welcome to Money for Lunch.
Hey, thanks for having me today, Bert.
You bet. All right, so let me ask you this. You're sitting around going, hey, we need to do a podcast. I mean, first of all, I love the name, School of Laughs. I think that's a great name. But what was the inspiration? What made you want to create a podcast called
School
of Laughs?
Well, it's interesting. Yeah, I've taught comedy classes here in Nashville for almost 14 years, and I kept having these people drive in from out of state. I had one guy that flew in from Texas all the way to Nashville 3 times in a row, and
wow.
I started thinking, you know, I've got to be able to reach people better than just having them come to me. And so I thought the podcast would be a great way to talk about things that were kind of in between the assignments and in between the lessons that I was teaching, but questions they still needed answered. So the first couple, we put a microphone up in front of some students, and they just asked some questions, and I kind of gave them my take on it. And then a funny thing happened. More people started driving in instead of just listening to podcasts. So I ended up putting on some online classes, and I think last check we have people in 9 different countries taking the classes and 23 countries listening to the podcast. So it seems like learning about laughing is something that people are really interested in, regardless of where they're at.
Yeah, it's interesting. Well, you know what? And you hear it everywhere, right, that not only is laughter good medicine, but, when you're going to start a presentation, you should open up with a joke. Knowing comedy is a fairly serious business.
Yeah, it's funny how the laughter will help people relax. It helps them receive your message better. And, if you're in sales, it helps them maybe absorb the sales pitch a little bit instead of being defensive when you talk. So tons of great places to put humor in every day. And I came across a statistic last week that I thought was kind of mind-blowing, but it makes sense. An average child laughs 300 times a day. How many times a day do you think the average adult laughs?
I'm going to say 3.
It's a little better than that, but not, it's 17, the average.
Oh, okay. All right.
Three maybe if you're working in toll booths. But 17, on the turnpike there. Maybe 3 on the turnpike. But, yeah, that's pitiful, isn't it? 17 times a day, and that's the average adult. So definitely some folks are not laughing at all. We talk about those people every day. But it's so many health benefits. I could rattle them all off, but you probably read the same ones. There's been hospitals where they bring in comedians or give their patients DVDs of comedies to help them relax, and it results in better patient cure rate and faster healing. And some people have actually done comedy or watched comedy before they go into labor and have avoided doing epidurals, all kinds of different things. I don't know if I would do that myself. But,
yeah.
But people,
it must have been
that's
really,
no
really
laughing
funny.
Matter. Yeah. Yeah, you've been,
all right. So,
you've been in
so
there.
Let's talk about this. Let's talk about this real quick. How can the average Joe start, or average Joette, I guess? So the average person, how can the average person start to develop comedic skills?
It's a good question. There's a lot of different ways you can do it. Best case scenario, they'd be somewhere close to a comedy club, and they could just take an improv comedy class. The great thing about improv is you only need to have 2 rules. And that's listening to what people are saying and agreeing with what they're saying and moving it forward. So there's not a lot of heavy lifting or homework to do. It's just being right there in the moment, if you will, and kind of playing along and bringing back that spirit of play like we had when we were kids, when we were laughing 300 times a day, is kind of key. So finding those little workshops or improv groups close to you is a great idea. If you don't have access to that, one thing you can do if you're not maybe a joke writer just yet, watch some comics you like on TV, maybe watch the monologues on the late night shows, and share a couple of those jokes with your friends or coworkers, and, that'll get them laughing. And then you or your coworker can, explore that topic a little bit further and maybe take the logic of the joke a little bit further and insert your own life into that joke. And so that way you're bringing a funny topic to the table, but there's no pressure on you to develop the topic right out of the gate.
Right, right. No, I like that, too. Yeah, it takes all the pressure off, and it's a great way to open up. It's a great way
just connect,
start a conversation. Yeah, connect. I like that. Yeah, connect. That's what I was looking for. All right. So you mentioned a couple of the stats there. I like those stats. Everybody has heard that, the power of laughing, right? I mean, there was a gentleman, Norman Cousins, who was battling cancer, and what he would do is he would do exactly what you're talking about. He got a bunch of movies, comedic movies, and watched them, and I think within like 30 days, his cancer was gone.
Yeah, I read about that recently. Isn't that pretty incredible?
It's very incredible. It just goes to show you the connection that we have between stress and illness and laughter and healing or health. And this stat of us adults not laughing more than about 17 times a day, that's the average, some are less, some are more, and kids on average laugh about 300 times a day, it goes to show you that maybe we're not enjoying life as much as we should.
Yeah, and the other flip side of that is people don't enjoy us as much as they should. I read a statistic that you know, being able to make somebody laugh makes you more attractive to them. So, you know,
yeah.
If you're nervous around people, a little laugh goes a long way. And I read this recently, too, as far as health benefits, laughing for 10 minutes, just 10 minutes each day, can burn the same number of calories as a half-hour workout. So, to me, that's a no-brainer. I'm just going to go to the gym and laugh at the guy doing squats, and in 10 minutes I'll be 20 minutes ahead of his workout, you know?
Yeah, there you go.
10 minutes a day, that's all. A half-hour cardio workout.
I like that, man. Yeah, let's just go to the gym and laugh at the other people. That's going to go over really well.
Yeah, here's my advice, though. Laugh at people that are smaller than you. If they're really bulked up, you might want
And don't be laughing at anybody in the showers or restroom. That's definitely a no-no.
Right.
All right, let me ask you this. What do you think, as a comedian, do you do clean comedy or what do they call it, blue comedy?
Yeah, there's always that debate between, you know, clean comedy and blue comedy, and I've always gone the clean comedy around. I realized early on when I was doing comedy clubs, I'd see comics up there that were dirty, and about half of the crowd didn't want any part of it, but the other half was laughing like twice as hard as they normally would at anything else. And then I saw comics go up and be clean, and the entire crowd can enjoy it. And what I kind of deducted from that was, you know, your job as a comedian is to entertain everybody, or at least give everybody access to your comedy. And when you're only entertaining half the crowd, and maybe they're laughing twice as much, so on stage it sounds like the whole crowd's laughing, but you're only entertaining 50%, that's a failure. I mean, that's a total failure. Now, on the flip side, if you're billed as a dirty comic and everybody in the crowd came there to see that, then you're successful at it. But your job really is to entertain everybody. And if you're eliminating part of your group by being dirty, you know, you're just not working hard enough, I don't think. You know, it's a skill and there's technique involved and you got to put some time in.
Yeah, I agree with you. Look, I like Kevin Hart, but I don't watch him very much because he does use a lot of profanity. And I personally don't think he needs it. Then there's another comedian that I follow quite a bit, Sinbad. He's hysterical. He's very clean. Jim Gaffigan's very clean. And, you know, my kids and I can sit down and listen to Sinbad or Jim Gaffigan, and I don't have to worry about him dropping some F-bombs or doing anything like that. And we are rolling on the ground laughing. In some cases, you know, I'm just, my eyes are tearing up because I'm laughing so hard. That to me is somebody who is, what do you call it? As you said, you know, they got their skills up there. They don't need the cheap stuff, the you know, whatever, the dirty humor, the gross humor that appeals to, I think, a lot less people. And quite frankly, if anybody's been at a comedy club or a live comedy event and they start using, you know, blue type language, I always feel uncomfortable, especially when they get into something that maybe is too explicit. You know, that I just, like you said, to me that's failure also. It's like, come on, it's not that funny.
Yeah, I think there's enough. I mean, if you look at the dictionary, how many words can you use on stage? There's like Carlin said, there's about seven that you can't. If you look at the dictionary, there's thousands and thousands of words that we have at our disposal. You have all your life experience. You have everything you've viewed of other people in the world, and you can write stories and write jokes, you know, and appeal to a broader base. Now, again, it's a marketplace like anything else, so there's places for dirty comedy, and there's great comics that are also well-crafted and can put their jokes together that are, you know, highly skilled dirty jokes, if you will. But for me, a guy with two kids and a guy who grew up Christian, I'd like to do some clean comedy and let the crowd decide.
Sure. Well, and on top of that, look, it's something that, you know, you can, since you brought up your kids, it's something that you your kids can listen to, and you know they're not going to say, hey, Daddy, why are you saying those bad words?
Or, right.
Why are you talking like that? So there's that. So you don't have to hide it from your kids. Also, as a keynote speaker, makes you a more appealing, I think, keynote speaker, because business people can trust you to keep it clean.
Right, and that's where there's a demand. You know, I get calls all the time from people that that are on the fence because two or three years ago they hired a comedian who said he was clean, and he came in and after 5 minutes, that was it, and then he was just dirty or, you know, not politically correct or not what they had bought. And so I kind of go in a lot of times to kind of clean up that mess and reset the table and you know, get the trust back because, you know, there's nothing more important than the trust that somebody gives me when they give me their audience for an hour. You know, I want to make sure that those people walk out of there not only with a good, solid laugh, but if they want some takeaways, I've got that too. And just really respect what the client asked me to do. And there's a big demand for that. There's not enough comics that can work clean and do that.
Absolutely. All right, so let's talk about this when it comes to comedy. You know, comedy has kind of like a dark side. There's been a lot of comedians over the decades who have unfortunately taken their life or have accidentally taken their life because it's kind of a dark side. There's a lot of comedians out there who really their humor comes from maybe stuff that they would call it their background, and some of their backgrounds are not happy ones. I mean, John Belushi was, John Belushi, and I know for some people are going, John who? But John Belushi is a guy who seemed to be very sad off stage, very happy on stage. There's been a couple other comedians there that, the guy who did, Black Sheep, what was his name? He co-starred with Spade in a couple of
Chris
comedies.
Farley.
Tommy Boy, thank you, Farley.
Chris Farley,
who was a funny guy, but his life also ended tragically. So, what is it about so many comedians that seem to have this dark, depressive side? Do you get that at all?
Yeah, I mean, I've seen it. You know, close friends, I've seen it with them. Few different thoughts about that. There was a recent survey and study done in the British Journal of Psychiatry, and they found that a lot of comedians, just like other creatives, have the same kind of personality traits as psychos. So I guess I'm in that group where you have the part of your brain that can be creative and also the part that is judging your creativity as you create it. So, you know, a lot of comedians have self-doubt as they're developing material. And a lot of great material never even gets to the stage because in the back of their mind they're like, well, this isn't good enough. And there's that pleasing the audience kind of dynamic that a lot of comics have that they simply can't overcome. So when the show's over and you've got, you know, 23 hours to downtime, they look elsewhere to get that high and to find that purpose. And sometimes that leads to drugs and self-destructive behavior and drinking and all those things. For me, what I try to do is focus on doing a great show for that 1 hour, and the rest of the time, I've got other meaningful things in my life, you know, but I think a lot of times comics get so wrapped up in that world, they don't have a balance in their life enough to where they can be okay with just being quiet off stage or, you know, not judging everything they do. And so, you know, it's kind of a sad thing to say, but a lot of comics probably grew up in a place where they weren't, their parents didn't pay enough attention to them, and now they're looking for that, you know, that pat on the back somewhere else.
Well, and I'm glad you brought that up because absolutely, you know, when you are a comedian or an actor or a singer, you know, when you're this creative energy, specifically the kind of creative energy that needs the applause or the approval of, you know, of a crowd, right? This can become very dangerous because it's addictive like anything else. And when only, you know, a few hundred or a few thousand people really validate you, really make you feel human, then I think you become kind of self-centered. You're focused only on yourself versus, well, as you were saying, you got other things better to do. You know, you got your kids that you got to raise. You got to, you know, you have other interests, and you have to have this balance. You have to have more interests other than being on stage or being an actor or being a singer or whatever, you know, however you want to phrase that. Otherwise, you're going to have a very unfulfilling, shallow existence.
I think so. I probably was in that same boat for a while when I first started, but the mind shift that helped me kind of get past all that is I look at my act like product, you know, and if you talk to developers, like app developers, they have these MVPs, the minimum viable products. So they're trying to get that out there and just kind of test it and see if the marketplace has a need for it. So when I'm on stage now, I kind of disassociate myself from my material, and I'm here to deliver an hour's worth of new product, and I put out new jokes, and if they don't like the joke, then I know that I need to improve that joke or swap it out and try something different, but it doesn't mean they don't like me because, you know, they were laughing 10 minutes ago. It's just this new joke didn't fit in there yet. So I look at every opportunity on stage as a chance to present new ideas as opposed to be judged and approved by the audience. So that really helped me make the change.
No, that's a great. I hope everybody who's a creative looks at that. You're putting out products versus putting yourself out there. That's a nice little shift there. Okay, so let's talk something. You know, let's I'm going to take this to a very serious point. Only because I grew up with Bill Cosby, and so to mm-hmm. me, you can't think of a great comedian and have Bill Cosby not enter that conversation. Today, of course, his conversation, or now when you talk about Bill Cosby, he's really tainted his name quite a bit. As a comedian, did that affect you? Were you like shocked? What's your take on Bill Cosby, one of the fathers of clean comedy?
Well, you know, the overriding emotion was just disappointment, you know. And those rumors have been around for over 10 or 15 years, and they kind of resurfaced a couple of years ago when Hannibal Buress, a comedian, was on stage talking about that. And somebody videotaped that and put it up on YouTube, and then a whole new generation found out about the accusations. And that kind of fueled the fire for everybody to step up and, you know, demand some answers. But it was just disappointing because that was one of the guys I watched growing up. But again, you know, I kind of, over the years, have learned to appreciate what somebody does on stage and not put any kind of, power on who they are off stage. Because I realize,
right.
You know, once again, they're presenting something. There's how many great actors that we've seen that have committed suicide or done horrific things, but their acting is good. How many great artists, you know? So something I try to teach my kids is you can appreciate what somebody does, but it doesn't make them necessarily a better or a great person or anybody that's better than you. It's just, it's their creation. So, you know, big time disappointment with Bill Cosby, but sadly enough, not overly surprising.
Yeah, that is sad. And you know what? It's interesting because I'd never heard of those rumors, but again, that's the difference between somebody who's just, out in the audience versus somebody who's in that industry. Because you're like the third comedian now who said, oh, yeah, you know, that was something that was widely known in the comedic circles, in the entertainment circle, that he had that rumor that he, you know, and it just stuck with him. But his public image was so good that it never stuck.
Right.
And like you said, sometimes you got to separate the public image from the private image, because a lot of times they're not a direct match. All right, so let's take it back to this. How did you go from being a stand-up comedian to a speaker at a corporate speaker / corporate comedian? How did that transition happen?
Yeah, there were two different points. The first point was just moving from doing comedy clubs to doing corporate events where they wanted a clean comedian. And that happened a while back. I noticed I was in December, when these companies and stuff would maybe go to the comedy club and treat their employees out tonight at the club, I was in really high demand. And there was one month where I worked 3 weeks at the same comedy club, and they probably had brought in 25 to 35 different corporate groups that during those 3 weeks. And after that, I realized, wait a second, they're using me to deliver the clean show that these corporate groups are looking for. Maybe I should promote myself to the corporate groups directly. And I would have had, you know, opportunity for 25 different shows,
right,
as opposed to being in that one comedy club for 3 weeks. So that was the first eye-opener for me. And then as far as delivering keynotes and some takeaways along with the comedy, you know, that was a big part of 2009 when the economy started tanking. And I had a guy call me up and said, hey, we've had you down. You know, we've got you coming in a few months to do your comedy. But if I put comedian in the memo section of this paycheck to you, we're going to get raked over the coals. You know, the economy's too tight. He said, yeah, I can still have you come in, but can you deliver a message while you're up there being funny? If you do that, I'll write down speaker, and we can do that. So basically he was saying, can you not be funny for a whole hour? And I'm like, yeah, I cannot be funny for a whole hour. I can prove that, I can prove that all over. 23 hours a day, I am not funny at all. But my problem originally was, you know, I said, you know, what topics would you like me to talk about? And he said, well, we can definitely have somebody talk about time management. We have somebody talking about setting goals and meeting deadlines. Can you do that? And I said, listen, I'm a comedian. I don't know if I can or not. He goes, well, I'll tell you what. You've got 4 months to write a speech. If you're able to write one, then you've met a deadline and you've reached a goal and you've managed your time. So I'm good with that. And so that kind of opened my eyes to, you know, I've got to be on par with all these other businesses. I was kind of just a comedian who picked up the phone and went where anybody called me to go. But I kind of got some rules together and business practices, and for the first time looked at it more seriously as a business and what can I learn from the way I do things to translate to teach other business people. And that first event went so well. I had a lady come up right afterwards and book me for 3 other events, and that was my first speech, and I thought, okay, there's something here where people want a message, but they also want to enjoy an hour, you know?
Right. Well, and I think that you have kind of a funny situation where a lot of us keynote speakers, we have a message and we want to add a little humor to it because we know that humor, emotion, makes that message connect better. You kind of had the reverse problem. You're a funny guy who now had to deliver, you know, had to insert maybe some serious messages in there, but the goal is the same. You know, whether you're a comedian or just a plain keynote speaker, your job is to teach and entertain for, you know, X amount of time.
Right. And, you know, the real eye-opening thing for me when I started to put together that first presentation was I looked at what jokes I had, and I define them in a different way. You know, typically, as a comedian, I'll write a set list out, and this joke is, you know, this group of jokes are about family, and this group of jokes about travel and what have you. But I looked beyond that and said, what is this joke really talking about? And so, for example, I've got a joke where I talk about my wife and I, and we're going out on a Valentine's Day date, and there's kind of a miscommunication. And in business terms, that's what that joke was about. It was about communication and me failing to communicate effectively. And so when I put together the speech, I could do that joke, get the laugh, and then step back and say, you know, that's funny, but what did I learn from that? And I was able to really look at my act in a whole different way and start to make the transformation that way with funny stories that people can relate to, and then the takeaway is right there and they remember it better.
I love it. Rick, we're out of time, but it's been a blast having you on the show. I'd love to bring you back and maybe grab some more tips how we can use comedy to deliver our messages with more meaning. Rick Roberts, thank you so much for stopping by and sharing.
Hey, I enjoyed it. Have a good one.
All righty. Good stuff there from comedian Rick Roberts. You can find him at schooloflaughs.com, schooloflaughs.com. Maybe he's the perfect guy for your next corporate event. As you can tell, he's funny and he's also serious and he's clean, and so he can deliver different messages for your audience. Quick commercial break, ladies and gentlemen. And we'll be right back.
Did you bring the camera phone?
I did.
Do you want to go first?
I've been waiting for this all day.
Okay, this is Fro and Stacy.
Introducing Chase Quick Deposit. Just photograph the front and back of your check using the Chase Mobile app on your iPhone and hit send.
It went through?
So cool.
This is so cool.
You want to try it? Yeah.
Okay.
All right, who's next?
Make a deposit from anywhere, anytime with your iPhone.
To Mr. and Mrs. Walker, why would they send my parents a check?
Chase what matters.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.
All right. We are back. Jamie Fuentes here on Money for Lunch. Jamie Fuentes is an executive coach. She is passionate about this line of coaching after a decade of experience in a corporate setting. As a leader, she's led multi-million dollar programs of teams of 50-plus while instituting transformational change across companies to shift moral productivity, employee retention. Jamie Fuentes, welcome to Money for Lunch.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
All right, let's talk about this. Let's talk about here you are. You're working. When you were working in this corporate setting, what made you go from corporate to coaching? What was the inspiration behind that transformation?
Sure. So I moved from coaching on a corporate level to a one-on-one level in addition to doing it by myself because I wanted to be able to do it with the way that I wanted to do it, not necessarily going around specific human resource policies, working with staff the way that I felt would be truly engaging to them one-on-one because, you know, everyone has different learning styles, different engagement styles. And if you've been in some corporate trainings, icebreakers, groups of 50, getting that message across isn't necessarily conducive when you're just bringing someone in for a lunch and learn. So since I was doing this on a professional level, working for another company, I was looking at all of these other coaches that were really inspirational to me, that they were really leading people on a one-on-one level. And that's ultimately what I wanted to do, is because when you can work with someone on an intimate level, you really get to the heart of what some of their goals are, what some of their hang-ups are, and what they need to do to move forward, whether in their personal or professional life.
Gotcha. I love that. Let's talk about goals. Here you are. We're still in, first quarter of the year.
Mm-hmm.
Statistically, they say that like a huge number, 95% or 80% or either way, it's a big number around 90% of us goal setters have given up on our goals by January 15th. Do you agree with this stat?
I don't want to say that they've given up. I think it's they don't have anyone to hold them accountable and they don't necessarily have a plan in place. That there are these phenomenal goals, which, you know, someone wants to lose 10 pounds, wants to lose 20 pounds. So they jump all the way in, which is phenomenal, but having those unrealistic expectations that that's necessarily going to happen overnight. And that's where, you know, having a coach or having someone accountable is really going to come in. That it's what plan do we have in place? You know, when you've slipped up, what excuse do you have? Is it a realistic excuse? Or are you just not wanting to stick to your plan? Or do you have unrealistic expectations that maybe we need to really rework your goals so we can set you up for success?
Yeah, I like that. I like that. All right, so let's talk about this. In your opinion, because here you are, you've worked with multi-million-dollar programs. You were managing teams of 50. When you're setting a goal, what's step one? Mm-hmm. What's that crucial first step?
Understanding the why behind that first step. So, is that goal weight loss? Is it to set up a Roth IRA? So what does that weight loss mean for you? Is it to be healthier, have more energy? Perhaps you went to the doctor recently and you've been flagged for high cholesterol or heart disease. If, let's say, we're doing a financial goal, because, you know, we are money for lunch, but it's what does that financial goal mean for you? Is it freedom? Is it saving for retirement? Is it saving for a children's college fund, being able to travel the world? And really tapping into what that means to you, because if you don't have the understanding behind your goal, you're not connecting to it on an intimate level.
Mm. Yeah, I like that. It's amazing how important it is for us to connect with things to really make them happen.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, what we do is we set these fantastic goals, which I love when my clients do this. It's, you know, they want to pay off 6 figures of debt within the next 18 months. I absolutely love it. But it's tapping into the why, that it's what does that financial freedom mean for you? And what plans are you putting in place? And how are you holding yourself accountable for those? So it's breaking them down into manageable steps that you can really start to check those boxes along the way. And if you do have a slip up along the way, understanding that that's all right, as long as it's not a recurring experience.
Yeah, I like the way you said that. As long as it's not a recurring experience.
Right.
And you know what? And of course, there's the wake up, right? If you're having the same thing over and over again, then you need to stop and figure out why. You need to look at it and see what's causing this recurrent experience. Maybe you need to get some help, but I'm glad you added that in there because, yeah, it's okay to fall, but if you're having it to deal with it over and over again, then it's something else. All right, so we got the why, and what's the next step?
That it's what I typically do, what I have my clients do is go through the SMART goal process, which I'm sure, you know, people that are listening are very understanding and keen on, but I'll go through it. So it's creating that very specific first step. Is it, you know, we'll go with money. So it's going to your bank or Fidelity, whoever it may be, and opening a Roth IRA. Then, you know, that measurable fit, it's how much do you want to contribute, whether it be on a weekly, monthly, annual basis, so you can measure your level of success. Then go into achievable. Is that initial step possible to achieve? That if I want to put $200 a month towards my savings, looking at the rest of my finances to make sure this is something I'm actually able to do. So I'm looking at all of my other bills, you know, my car note, my mortgage payments, how much am I putting on groceries, what other outstanding debt, if any, do I have, what am I paying my bills, so on and so forth. Excuse me. And then, you know, that reasonable, how reasonable is it that you're able to do this at this specific time? Or do we need to look at maybe pushing that goal back for the next quarter, the next month, that when can we actually start this? The next, you know, that T is that time oriented, that what is the goal? Because one of the big things about setting a goal is having a date and time associated with it. So there's something on the calendar that you're actually working towards.
Yeah, I like that. And you know what? It's something I want to talk about real quickly is you mentioned this thing about being accountable.
Mm-hmm.
Accountability is something that it's something that we as adults hate, right? We don't want to be held accountable.
Oh, yeah.
But at the same
mm-hmm.
time, we know that
Absolutely.
Accountability is one of those shortcuts to success. When
mm-hmm.
somebody holds you accountable, you're going to get more done. When you have to report
Absolutely.
To your boss or your wife or your spouse or whoever, you're going to bring a certain level of energy that you don't bring when it's all yourself.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And one of the things that I encourage with having that level of accountability, now granted, if you have a boss, chances are the buy-in is already there. But
right.
that buy-in, that the person, you know, your wife, your friend, whoever it may be, is behind you with this goal, that they're encouraging you and checking in with you along the way, that it's where are you with this level of progress? Or, you know, even better, you know, having that individual check in with their accountability, but for lack of a better term at this time. But it's, here I am, this is the progress that I've made, these are the tasks that I put in place to work towards my progress. And if I'm not necessarily meeting these goals, look into why. What's come up that's held me back for this? Now that I know some of these things have come up, what processes am I going to put in place that if this comes up again, I can work through it and start to plan in advance?
Yeah, no, I like that. You know, bottom line is, if you're serious, if your why is big enough, going back to what
mm-hmm.
we were talking about earlier, if your why is big enough, you're going to put some accountability in place because it means that much to you.
Right, right.
Otherwise,
absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, otherwise you're going to be like I said earlier, that 80% or 90% that those goals tend to go into the wastebasket a little bit, or they get they get ignored or forgotten.
Right.
All right. So let me ask you this. Here I am. I'm self-employed. Maybe I have a small practice. Whatever. How can I, Jamie, hold myself accountable? What are some of the things that you would suggest to somebody who is their own boss and doesn't have anybody that they actually are accountable to? How can I hold myself accountable?
Sure. I mean, one of the things right off the bat is hiring an executive coach. I mean, that's what I do professionally is working with them. What is it that's their goal? Do they want to double their revenues in the second quarter? Do they want to pay off whatever debt they may have, so on and so forth, and putting some things in place. Now, however, if you don't hire a coach, what I would look into is, are you the CEO of your company? Is it just you? Do you have other partners? So if you have other partners, I would really look at collaborating with your executive team and holding each other accountable along the way. That it's person A may be responsible for marketing. So one of their goals is to bring in X amount of new subscribers, whatever that may be, and then working through how are they going to put that in place. So you've got someone checking you. The other thing is, if you are truly on your own, writing your goals down and looking at them every single day and doing the best you can to hold yourself accountable, bringing in a spouse, a best friend, consultant, whoever it may be, so you have a voice to bounce these ideas off of, and checking in with yourself along the way. If you're not meeting your goals, start to look at where are you spending your time. That it's, you know, the internet's huge. I mean, we've all been at that place where we look at one, two YouTube video, and then an hour and a half later, we're still on YouTube. Or, you know, you get on Facebook, you click on one picture, and you just go with it. So one of the things I advise my clients is actually scheduling some time that you know you're going to work and some time that you're going to play. So if you absolutely love going to the movies, maybe a Wednesday matinee is your thing. You put that time on the calendar so you know you have to be productive before and after so you can actually go and fully enjoy that movie.
Yes. Now, let me ask you this. So let's say that you've scheduled this movie for Wednesday matinee, which I think is a fantastic idea. Are we using that movie as a reward? So if I've stayed on course for Monday, Tuesday, then Wednesday afternoon I get to play. Is that the way you would use that?
That's how I would do it. I 100% am behind rewards. That I think that's something we need to do, especially when we are really keeping on track with what we need to do. That, you know, go out for dinner with your significant other, go see that movie, you know, spend whatever it may be, time going to the beach, just getting a little bit of self-care in. Because one of the big things, especially with CEOs, entrepreneurs, small business owners, is we have a tendency to work ourselves into the ground because this is our dream, this is our vision. And sometimes along the way, we can forget to take care of ourselves.
Yes. Yes. I like the way you said that. We sometimes do forget to take care of ourselves. All right. So, listen, we're out of time, but I want to say thank you so much for stopping by. It's been a blast having you on the show, talking about holding ourselves accountable. Setting SMART goals, S-M-A-R-T. It's a great acronym. Look it up if you're not familiar with it. Jamie Fuentes, thank you so much for stopping by and sharing.
Thank you so much. Take care.
You bet. Good stuff there from Jamie Fuentes about reaching your goals. You know, we don't want to be held accountable, but we certainly want the benefits of being held accountable, right? Being held accountable, if that makes your dreams come true, wouldn't you do that? Wouldn't you go out and get a coach or a friend or a mentor or somebody to hold you accountable? Remember, you were created to succeed.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch and check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.